Amen. Luke chapter 8. And we've been talking about the miracles of Jesus, haven't we? And we've been linking that in with together at 4 in the afternoon. And we're on Jairus' daughter. We're talking about Jairus' daughter, the raising of Jairus' daughter in Luke chapter 8. Now, this may not seem relevant, but those of you who know my wife will know that she hates being a minister's wife, for a start, because she gets used for illustrations all the time, is that she loves art. She likes a bit of art. I'm not quite so arty. I'm more science fiction, but she's more art. And she loves nothing better than escorting her husband around art galleries all over the place. And we've been privileged to go through quite a few, some great ones in the UK. We even got to the Louvre a couple of years ago, which was a real experience, fantastic. See some of the great masters. And Luke, if you read the book of Luke, you discover that he's a bit of an art lover too, because he's arranged his gospel almost like one of these things. He's arranged it like an art gallery. And he's put certain scenes in certain rooms for you to make a point. That's what he's done. In each room, in each chapter, he's arranged the scenes of Jesus' life. Three of those rooms or chapters are full of miracles. Three of those rooms are just full of those scenes. Room 4 and 5, chapter 4 and 5 in his art gallery, in his book, a collection of Jesus' earlier works. And they're all scenes that have crowded canvases. In every time you hear this phrase, vast crowds came to hear him preach and be healed. And it's as if all of these are huge pictures with vast crowds of people watching what Jesus is doing. Like Peter's mum's house is crammed to the rafters, isn't it, when he heals Peter's mum. And the synagogue is full of worshippers when he heals that man possessed by a demon. And the house with the lame man, well, he isn't even in the house. He has to fight through a crowd, knock a hole in the roof, and get lowered down because there's such a crush around Jesus. And all the scenes are this huge, vast crowds that are swamping Jesus and coming around him. And it seems as though rooms 4 and 5, chapters 4 and 5, are for the general public. They're for everybody to see, to know that this is a sign of who Jesus is. This is important. This is a declaration of Jesus' identity as the Messiah, the one who comes to heal and to change. But today I want to take you into room 8, chapter 8 of Luke's art gallery. And these are pictures from Jesus' later period, and each has only a few figures in them. No vast crowds in these scenes, just a few people. He's alone on a lake with just his disciples with him. Or he's on the shore of the Gerasenes and he's healing one man who is alone on that shore. Nobody else around, no crowds to watch it other than his disciples. Or he's in a room with Jairus' daughter and there's just mum and dad and three of his closest in a circle with him when he does the most amazing thing for the first time in his ministry. He raises someone from the dead. Only a handful see it. You see, room 4 and 5 are for the general public. Here is Jesus, here's who he is. Room 8, chapter 8, is just for you. This was written, and this has been preached on today, for you, the church, the people of God. And this is a special message from Luke to you. Something you need to know if you are going to follow Jesus. This year I got invited to a special viewing of it on a gallery on the Mall. This doesn't happen to me routinely, trust me. I never get invited to these. But I got invited onto the Mall in a little gallery there to see some work by a guy called Benjamin Hanvey Cousin. It was a real privilege. And I got invited along to see those pictures. I got invited along not because I could afford them. One of them was £24,000. So I obviously hadn't been invited along because he thought I could buy one. He knows I'm a pastor. He knows I'm probably not buying art at that level. The reason I was invited along is that Ben was in my youth group when I was about 20 and he was about 12. And it was lovely to be able to see him, realize that he's now this man, and that just made me feel very old all of a sudden. But amazing to see his work and what he's done and how he's come on, and that he's selling paintings for 24,000. Luke does the same to you and me. He invites you into room 8 in his art gallery. He invites you in because of your relationship with Jesus. That's why he's invited you in. This is a room just for you, because you know Jesus and you're invited. And he wants you, his disciples, to see something. So let's read it together. Luke chapter 8. Luke chapter 8, and this is what it says. Verse 40 of Luke chapter 8. On the other side of the lake, because he'd just been over there and just healed that man alone on the shore. On the other side of the lake, the crowds welcomed Jesus because they'd been waiting for him. Then a man named Jairus, the leader of the local synagogue, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come home with him. His only daughter, who was about 12 years old, was dying. And as Jesus went with him, he was surrounded by the crowds. So the crowds have reappeared at this point. A woman in the crowd who had suffered for 12 years and constant bleeding, and she could not find a cure. Coming up behind Jesus, she touched the fringe of his robe, and immediately the bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. Everyone denied it. Peter said, "Master, this whole crowd is pressing upon you." But Jesus said, "Somebody deliberately touched me, for I felt healing power go out from me." When the woman realized that she could no longer stay hidden, she began to tremble and fell to her knees in front of him. The whole crowd heard her explain why she had touched him and that she had been immediately healed. "Daughter," he said to her, "your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking to her, a messenger arrived from the home of Jairus, the leader of the synagogue. He told him, "Your daughter is dead. There's no use troubling the teacher now." But when Jesus heard what had happened, he said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just have faith, and she will be healed." When they arrived at the house, Jesus wouldn't let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, James, and the little girl's father and mother. The house was filled with people weeping and wailing, and he said, "Stop the weeping. She isn't dead, she's only asleep." But the crowd laughed at him because they all knew she had died. And Jesus took her by the hand. He said in a loud voice, "My child, get up." Now that moment, her life returned, and she immediately stood up. Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were overwhelmed, but Jesus insisted that they not tell anyone what had happened. Fantastic story. The story begins with some very urgent business. Jesus has just been across the Sea of Galilee in the Gerasenes, and now he's back, and no sooner is his boat on the shore than it feels like room 4 and 5 again. It feels like the crowds are pressing in once more. And he's accosted by a desperate man. His name is Jairus. Everybody knows Jairus. This is Caesarea. Everybody knows Jairus. Jairus is a deacon. Jairus is on the PCC. Jairus is the church warden. He arranges services. He books preachers. He picks the songs. Everybody, every good devout Jew knows Jairus. He's the man who leaves the note on the lectern for the preacher. Kiss. Keep it short, stupid. That's him. He's the man who comments on the sermon. I particularly liked your passage. Which passage was that? Well, the passage between the pulpit and the exit. That's who Jairus was. He was that sort of guy. He's respected and he's respectable. He has authority. He has power, in a sense. But today he has urgent business. So he throws respectability to the wind and he throws himself at Jesus' feet. And it's possible that Jairus was one, we think it's possible that he was one of the elders that, if you turn back a chapter, you'll discover a similar scene where a Roman centurion has a servant who he loves who is dying and he sends for Jesus. But instead of going himself, who does he send? He sends the elders. It could have been Jairus. As one of the leaders of the synagogue, it could have been Jairus, who only a chapter before is having to ask this strange, crazy preacher to come and to heal the Roman centurion's servant. It could have been him. Jairus may have seen what Jesus can do already, and that's why he may have found himself at this moment at Jesus' feet. He knew what he could do. His daughter, his only daughter, is near death's door. We don't know what the illness was. We only know there wasn't much time. And he believed Jesus could help. So Jesus sets off on urgent business for an important man, a respected man. And they're on their way. If you live long enough, you soon discover that tragedy, disease, death, all of these things are no respecter of persons. They don't respect you based on what your position is in society, based on how respected you are in your community, based on how much wealth you have. They don't respect those things, do they? They come to us all. Nobody is immune from them. I wonder how many of us think because we're maybe young or healthy or financially secure, or even because we love and serve God, that we'll never have to face anything difficult or tragic, that we'll never have to face loss. And the reality is that these things are part of our existence and part of our world. Jairus' position couldn't help him, and ours won't help us when it comes to these things. They are not ifs, they are when. So, I suspect Jairus found himself asking what we've all asked when he'd been serving God so faithfully and when he'd been trusting God and when he'd been trying to help others to connect with God through the synagogue. I suspect he at times would sit at home and yell up at the ceiling, "Why me? Why me?" He's been devout, he's served, he's tried to live a good life when others maybe didn't care about a good life. He's tried to do the right thing rather than the wrong thing when he's seen so much in society when he thinks, well, they don't do it, but I will, because it's the right thing to do. I'll honour God. When he's shown compassion in God's name, Jairus did all of those sort of things. And yet here he is with a daughter, 12-year-old, dying. I bet he said, "Why me?" I would have. But the truth is, loss is a part of this life. It's part of being in a broken world. Loss is there. It was never meant to be. It was never meant to be. At the beginning was this unending, uninterrupted fellowship between man and God, with no end in sight, no sell-by date, no finish, no goodbyes. None of that was ever supposed to be there. But it is now. And we all know it is now. And all hope lies in the one who can restore his creation to its original design. We think of death as normal. Death isn't normal. Death shouldn't exist. Death is a consequence of our decision to go it alone. The wages of sin the wages of independence from God is death. And all hope now lies in the one who can restore creation to what it was supposed to be, not what it has become. And the one who will one day put an end to all loss. I look forward to that day. I don't know about you. You ever had to say goodbye? You ever been to a funeral? You ever had to do any of that stuff? And most of us here have. One day, he will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, no more goodbye. Or mourning, or crying, or pain. Why? Because the old order of things, the order that we have put in place, not that he put in place, the old order of things has passed away. We look forward to that day. So Jairus puts his trust in a man who seems able to reverse the damage done to creation. Who seems able to reverse the loss that we all experience time and time and time again. The thing that wasn't supposed to be part of our experience. But then, of course, things get out of hand because things never work out the way you plan, do they? On his way to Jairus' house, Jesus' popularity starts to work against him. And like a pop star on his way to the stage door, Jesus gets mobbed. And as usual, the disciples are doing their best bouncer act, trying to get him through the crowd and trying to get the go along the way. And it does no good. And the problem just gets worse. And around the corner, there's this woman in the crowd. She wasn't a big gun like Jairus. She was completely different to Jairus. Here was the village outcast. Here was someone who lived not in the manse next door to the synagogue. Here was someone who lived in the council estate. She didn't get to church. In fact, she never set foot, probably, in Jairus' church. She wasn't allowed. Jewish law says this: when a woman has her regular flow of blood, the impurity of her monthly period will last 7 days, and anyone who touches her will be unclean till evening. So during that time, women weren't allowed to mingle and mix with others. This woman had been bleeding not for a week, for 12 years. 12 years of isolation. So here we have an insider and an outsider, both running out of options, both running out of time, both experiencing what they should never have experienced in this creation, loss, real loss. Both desperate. And that desperation led them, an insider and an outsider, they both end up at Jesus' feet. Why? As a Christian called Bruce Larson, and for many years he worked in a church in New York, and he would counsel people, any number of people from his office there, people who were wrestling with this idea of whether they should go to Jesus or not. Probably a bit like this woman who was debating, well, shall I go to this prophet, this Jesus, or not? And Jairus, shall I risk my reputation and go to this Jesus or not? They got desperate, so they did it anyway. But most people aren't that desperate, so they have the conversation, and they had it with Bruce Larson. And often he would suggest that they take a little walk with him. And he would walk from his office down to the RCA Center, the RCA building, the Rockefeller Center, no, Radio City Center on Fifth Avenue. And at the entrance of that building is a statue. And he would take them to the statue, and he would show it to them. Here's the statue. Statue of Atlas, powerful figure, with all the muscles straining, holding the world on his shoulder. There he is, the most powerful man built in the world, and he can hardly stand up under the strain of the world on his shoulders. And Bruce Larson would say to the person who he'd taken for a little stroll, he'd say, now that is one way to live. To bear the weight of your world on your shoulders. That is one way you can live. And on the other side of Fifth Avenue, directly opposite the RCA building, you'll see a church. That's St. Patrick's Cathedral. And he would walk them from that statue into St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. And behind the high altar, he would take them around the back and he would show them a little statue. And here's the statue. It's a statue of the little boy Jesus, perhaps 8 or 9 years old, and with just one hand, he is holding the world. Like a child would hold a toy. And he would say, this is the other way to live your life, carrying your own burden yourself, or trusting to someone who can help you carry it. Now, I don't know what your burden is. Wouldn't presume to know. I don't know what you're struggling with. I suspect loss will be one of them. It's impossible to go through life without loss, isn't it? We all go through losses. And it's not just bereavement. It's loss of all sorts of things. Every change in your life involves a loss, doesn't it? Every circumstance that changes, every season of life that changes, all of these things involve loss. I don't know what your burden is, I don't know, but we all have a choice. Whether we're an insider or an outsider, we can carry it on our own shoulders, or we can say, I can't do this alone. I'm not God. I need someone who can hold it easily for me. With me. Here's my world. Here's my whole world. Will you help me carry it? We all have that choice. Both Jairus and this woman took that risk. They took the risk of going to Jesus and believing that he could help them carry their burden. It always feels risky to trust Jesus, and we only do it like them when we're desperate most of the time, don't we? We only pray when we've done everything else. It feels like a risk to trust Jesus, to have faith in him. It feels like a risk to do that. And often we will hold on to other things and trust other things rather than him, even if some of those other things aren't doing us any good. Have you ever found that? You ever found it's quite hard to change? It's hard to change because even the bad things that you do, there's a payoff. It serves you in some way. Otherwise, why would you ever do it? But even the stuff that is hurting us and damaging us, we hold on to things. Often we hold on to unhelpful things. Because they serve us, instead of trusting Jesus, instead of getting to him. We stay angry because it gives us control. Anger keeps you in control when we fear not being in control. We stay a victim because, well, people are going to care for me if I'm the victim, if I'm the child all the time. People are going to care for me. But it's killing you, and you hate it, and you resent it, but you still keep doing it. We play the martyr because it gives us respect. And we sacrifice this, that, and the other to great personal damage and cost sometimes. Only to fuel our own lack of respect for ourselves. We hang on to all sorts of things that are not good for us to do or to be or to operate like. And we do it because they serve us. But they're often unhelpful. And what is left if I give them up? What is left if I let them go? Some of us think holding on makes us strong, but sometimes letting go takes even more strength. Letting go of those things. Not all loss is bad. There are some losses in our lives that we desperately need. For Jairus, I suspect it was his pride. The decision to lose his pride and to trust Jesus. To take a risk with his reputation. For this woman, I suspect it was, well, illness can sometimes benefit, can't it? Everybody pays attention to you. Everybody cares for you. Or hopefully. And she would lose that. What would be left? She would have to take responsibility for her own life if she let go of this. They're probably both scared. A lot of people are scared, and fear can keep you trapped. Fear can keep you prisoner in an old way of being that isn't serving you any good anymore. These two somehow managed to break that, but most people struggle, even though they could break it. I read a little statistic, this is an odd, the stuff I read is bizarre, but here you go. Did you know that the African, this is a useless, it's like a cracker thing, this. African impala can jump to a height of over 10 feet and a distance of 30 feet. Did you know that? I knew you were wondering what this has got to do with the sermon. I'll tell you in a minute. Did you know that he could jump 10 feet high and 30 feet long? An impala, it's like a deer. African impala, fantastic animals. Did you know that every zoo in the world keeps them behind a 3 foot high wall? They do. These things can clear it without batting an eyelid. You know why they don't? Because they can't see what's on the other side of the wall, so they don't jump. But they could. But fear of not knowing what's over that wall stops them all the time. It's what we do with change, why we don't give up the things that are hurting us. It's why we're scared sometimes to trust Jesus. We don't know what the alternative is, and we're scared of that. So we don't jump, even though we could so easily make the jump. Faith is the ability to do what? To trust what you can't see. Faith is being sure of what you hope for and certain of what you do not see, and to jump anyway. With faith, we're free from flimsy enclosures that hold us in and stop us from moving on and moving forward, that only fear keeps us a prisoner to. And for Jairus, that faith was tested. By the time this woman had been healed by Jesus in the press of the crowd, vital minutes have passed, and the news gets to him. Your daughter's dead. There's no point troubling the teacher now. If only. I suspect he'd done the why me bit, and now he's on the if onlys. If only, life is full of those. If only Jesus hadn't been on the other side of the lake and been in Caesarea where he normally was, why did he have to make that trip? If only this wretched woman hadn't have delayed him on the way. If only. And Jairus encounters that thing all over again, loss, loss, loss again. And Jesus, seeing his anger and his grief and his fear written large across his face, his regret even, he turns to him and he says this, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, only believe." Jesus leads Jairus and his wife into the room where this little girl lay, and he takes, this is interesting who he takes, Peter, who would one day open up the gospel to the whole non-Jewish world, to the Gentile world, but would lose his life and would face persecution in the course of it, would face loss. And he takes Peter in. He takes John in, who would one day, if you know your Bibles, would one day find himself sat on an island in exile in Patmos, separated from his friends and his family and his church and the people he loved, and would face immense loss in his life. And James, who would one day lead the church in Jerusalem, a church which would know immense loss as persecution fell upon it, as brothers and sisters in Christ were martyred for their faith, lost their jobs for their faith, were ridiculed and persecuted for their faith. And he takes these three guys who would one day have to face loss all the time, and he takes them into this room because they need to see this. They will need to remember this in the future, in this broken world where loss, which isn't supposed to be here, is. And he says in Aramaic, Talitha kumi, my child, get up. And she does. And she does. And once again, he reverses the damage done to this world and to our worlds and to our lives because of loss. He reverses it before their very eyes. And then he says, get us some food. Firstly, because he knows what teenagers are like and they're always hungry. And secondly, because he's not just all-powerful God. He's an all-compassionate God who thinks about the little things that matter to you and me. Get us some food. And the message, which I mentioned at the beginning, from these pictures in room 8 of Luke's art gallery, the message from these pictures that he wants you, his disciples, to specifically go in and see is this. The loss will be a part of life. It is a part of life. Despite your dedication to Jesus, loss is a part of your life too. It was for Jairus, it was for James, it was for Peter, it was for John, it was for Jesus. Loss will be a part of your life too. Life will be full of losses. Every transition that you go through, you will experience loss. From childhood to your teens, you'll experience loss. From teens to being an adult, you'll experience loss. From single to married, you'll experience loss. From married to single, you'll experience loss. From working to retired, you experience loss. Every change of house, of job, in your age, in your relationship, you experience loss. There are so many of them, aren't there? Think about it. Your losses in your life. There's a very big long list of them. In fact, you'll experience loss as a believer even more because listen to this. Jesus said, love each other as I have loved you. And if you're going to start loving people deeply, guess what the flip side of that is? Loss. If you never want to experience loss, never love anybody. It's the only way you avoid it. And that's no way to live. And Jesus says, love each other as I have loved you. You especially will experience loss if you take his command and you love people. It's never part of his plan. It is part of your experience now. So Jesus says, as you walk into room 8 and look at the pictures, don't be shocked. Don't be confused. Don't be surprised. But most of all, says Jesus to you who know what loss is, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Jesus performed 3 resurrections during his ministry. This was the first, and it happened almost immediately after death. Next was the widow's son in Nain, and that was the day after that son had died. Then the next one after that came Lazarus. That was 4 days after he died. And the most amazing of all was not raising somebody else, but raising himself 3 days after being in the tomb. And Jesus says, you'll experience loss. It isn't part of the plan. It's not supposed to be here. But you will experience it, but don't be afraid. Why? Because of this. Because the Master himself will give the command. There will be archangel thunder, God's trumpet blast. He will come down from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise. They'll go first. And the rest of us who are still alive at that time will be caught up with them into the clouds to meet the Master. Oh, we will be walking on air. And then there will be one huge family reunion with the Master. So reassure one another with these words. Walk into room 8 of Luke's gallery and reassure yourself. Don't be afraid. Because even loss will one day be removed from your experience. And it says, we'll sing a new song. We'll sing a new song. You are worthy. We'll look him in the eye. And on that day, you will declare, Jesus, you are worthy. You are worth it. You are worth every loss I encountered on that broken planet. You were worth it. And you will know when you look him in the eye that that is true. He is worth every loss in your life. He is worth it. And he is the only one who can roll back time, who can cancel loss. And one day he will. And when you say you are worthy, you were worth it. You know what he'll do? He'll do to you what he did to that 12-year-old. He'll say, come and have something to eat. And there will be a feast, a massive feast. It's called the Feast of Abraham. And all will be invited. You will be invited to it. A feast that specifically celebrates what Jesus has achieved. The end of the experience of loss in your life forever. Hallelujah. I hope you enjoy a wander around room 8. I know that Peter and John and James needed to see that to prepare them to know that even in the loss of their experience in the future, they would trust. They would trust. I hope you can too. And I hope that you enjoy the pictures that you find in that room. Shall we stand together? Let's stand and let's worship him. Who is there like Jesus? Who is there like this one who, not straining under a globe, but holds it in his hand and can reverse the world as we know it? Who is there like him? And we're going to trust in his cross and in his blood and in his righteousness that achieves all that for us.